Bogby and Tim Laker. All types of players flocked to Radomski. In 1995, for instance, Laker was a nondescript backup catcher for the Montreal Expos who was ready to jump the two hurdles of the health risk and the morality issue to get his hands on steroids. Seguy was his connection, even though Seguy had joined him as a teammate with the Expos only on June 8th of that same year. Seguy put Laker in touch with his own steroid supplier, Radomski. Laker and Radomski met at the New York City Hotel where the Expos stayed while in town for a series against the Mets. Laker was 25 years old and owned a lifetime major league batting average of .205 with no home runs entering that 1995 season. He was the very definition of a fringe player, at risk at any time of being washed back to the minors and possibly even out of the game. He had trouble putting on weight, which he later blamed on a digestive disease for which he was diagnosed 3 years earlier. The brass ring, however, was to hang around the big leagues long enough to make some money, provide for his family, and maybe even qualify for one of those nice pensions for which the Players Association had bargained. What would you do for the brass ring? Work hard and eat right? Sure. But what if that wasn't enough? What if there was something else, even if it was illegal, that could bring the brass ring further into reach? And what if you knew that there were no rules against it? And what if you knew guys in your clubhouse and guys across the field were taking it? Laker gladly took the leap over the two hurdles. Radomski set him up with a doping regimen of DECA and testosterone. Laker would administer it himself. The catcher would inject himself in the buttocks once a week for 8 to 10 weeks, take some time off, in parts of the body's natural testosterone production, fooled by the synthetic drugs would not shut down entirely, and then crank up another cycle. When the Expos were home, Laker would shoot up at his residence. When they were on the road, he would shoot up in his hotel room, which presented something of a problem as far as how to dispose of the dirty syringes laced with an illegal drug. Laker decided he would wrap them up and transport them in his belongings out of the country and back to Montreal. He would dispose of them there. Laker put on weight. The Montreal trainer complimented him on his improved physique. He kept doping for 6 years. Tim Laker did not transform into a star, even with the help of performance-enhancing drugs. He never became an all-star who hit 41 home runs in a season. He never set the home run record or made the cover of Time magazine or hit balls more than 500 feet or aroused suspicion from the media or fans. But he did carve out a major league career that included parts of 11 seasons and a .226 batting average. He was still in the big leagues at age 36. Tim Laker was nothing special. No, there were hundreds and hundreds of Tim Lakers out there in professional baseball. It's unfortunate, Helling said, that I had a lot of people I knew say, I feel like I need to do something to keep up. They'd say, I played with this guy for 4 or 5 years and suddenly he's hitting 30 home runs. We play the same position. I need to keep up. You hear excuses from guys who've admitted juicing. I felt like I had to do it. I did it to keep healthy. The way I looked at it, when I wasn't good enough myself, it was time to move on. A lot of players didn't think that. When they lost velocity or they did not have enough power to hit home runs, guys always had an excuse for why they could do it. Laker became yet another Radomski success story. The story might have been small scale, but it was a success story nonetheless. It was a story that was being repeated with growing frequency in every major league clubhouse, including that of the model franchise of Major League Baseball, the New York Yankees. 1998 was also the year Roger Clemens met Brian McNamee, Tim McCleary's St. John's buddy hired to be the Blue Jays' strength coach. McNamee had earned his doctorate at something called Columbus University in Louisiana, which later would move to Mississippi after being shut down in Louisiana, after it was found to be an online diploma mill. Clemens and McNamee made a connection, not so much as personal friends, but as devotees of training. Clemens loved to work, but he always needed company, almost in the manner of someone who needed an audience rather than a taskmaster. McNamee, quiet and perpetually somber, was not a gregarious audience. But he was loyal, industrious, and serious almost to a fault about training. McNamee gained Clemens' trust. That was never more apparent than in June of that season, just months after they had met, when Clemens asked McNamee to stick a needle full of Winstrol in his buttocks, according to what McNamee told Mitchell in the presence of federal agents and later repeated in a sworn deposition to Congress. Clemens, several times, including in front of a congressional committee, denied ever using steroids and filed a defamation lawsuit against McNamee. "I knew nothing about it until Clemens came to me and asked me to stick him in the ass in 98," McNamee said. "Winstrol was stupid good. You get a guy throwing 82 miles per hour, he takes Winstrol, he's throwing 92. It's a sprinter's drug, for fast-twitch muscle fiber. If I took Winstrol in college, I would have thrown 100, without a doubt. I don't know if it existed then, but yeah, Ben Johnson took it. It's a big sprinter's drug. Hamstring, rotator cuff, oh, it definitely works. Horses were taking it." Clemens already was among the greatest pitchers of his generation, if not of all time. Clemens on a steroid regimen, as alleged by McNamee, was literally unbeatable. Clemens went 14-0 with a 2.29 ERA for the rest of the season. In his final 11 starts alone that season, Clemens' game-by-game strikeout totals were 14, 8, 15, 6, 18, 7, 11, 7, 11, 15, and 11. Only one other time in Clemens' career did he strike out at least 14 batters four times in an entire season, and that had occurred when he was 10 years younger. And yet, in 1998, he did it in just the last 2 months of a season in which he threw 234 and two-thirds innings at the advanced age of 36. It was a freakishly phenomenal season, but like many achievements in 1998, gained little recognition because of the overwhelming fascination with Maguire, Sosa, and the great home run race. The Yankees noticed. They traded an 18-game winner off their 125-win team, Wells, the same pitcher who had thrown a perfect game, too, to get Clemens from the Blue Jays at the start of their 1999 spring training camp. Clemens wanted his new buddy and trainer, McNamee, to join him with the Yankees. There was a problem, though. McNamee was under contract to the Blue Jays. "He tried to get me out of my contract in 99," McNamee said. "I had a player's contract, and he wanted me out of there by the All-Star break. The only thing is, the Blue Jays would have filed a grievance, and I would have been unable to work with the team for 6 or 7 years because I broke my contract. And that's why I didn't leave. I wanted to leave the door open to get back into Major League Baseball. So I let it go." Without McNamee, Clemens did not pitch well in New York. Clemens' ERA jumped by nearly 2 runs in 1999 to 4.60, the worst mark of his career. He did win the clinching game of the World Series against Atlanta. Just weeks later, McNamee said Clemens called him. "You're not going back to Toronto," Clemens said. "Okay," McNamee said. "I'll train you." McNamee, the New York kid, was happy about coming home. There were a couple of issues that needed to be worked out, though. Clemens didn't want to have to fly McNamee around the country to train him while the Yankees were on the road, so he petitioned the Yankees to make McNamee a strength coach. But the Yankees already had a strength coach, Jeff Mangold. Did they need another one? They did if they wanted to keep Clemens happy and productive. McNamee flew to Tampa to meet with Yankees general manager Brian Cashman and assistant Mark Newman. A deal was struck. McNamee would be named as the team's assistant strength coach with a base salary, full medical benefits, and complete access to the Yankees' players and facilities. There was only one catch. Clemens would have to pay McNamee's salary. The Yankees would deduct the money from Clemens' salary and give it to McNamee. The arrangement now suited Clemens, who now had his personal trainer with him at all times on the staff of the New York Yankees, without the bother of having to make separate travel arrangements for him, or the worry of trying to gain him access to club facilities. Even McNamee found it odd that one player, acquired in a trade, not even with the leverage of free agency, essentially appointed his personal trainer to the team, a team that had forged its reputation on turning unselfishness into championships. "It was set up to fail," McNamee said, "because I went in there to try to help, and Roger put up a front, and it was like me versus Mangold. Mangold was Joe's guy, but Roger would tell the players to go see me, not Mangold. And I hated going to work every day. McNamee had trained Clemens, Andy Pettit, and pitcher C.J. Nikowski in Houston that winter after the 1999 season. When McNamee arrived at the Yankees' 2000 spring training camp, it took only the first minute of the first stretching exercises of the first day of workouts for trouble to start. McNamee was leading the team in stretching when Cohn, the respected elder statesman of the Yankees, yelled at him with only a modicum of humor that intentionally could not disguise his anger. "What the fuck are you doing here leading stretching?" Cohn yelled for all of his teammates to hear. "Did you get a quickie degree? What are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here doing this." Cohn went on to trash McNamee so badly that the pitcher admits, "I was getting a little embarrassed because it was in front of the whole team." Cohn, the old-school union man, was upset not only because he felt the Yankees catered to Clemens' wants by hiring him, but also because he regarded McNamee as a gatecrasher, somebody who had entered the elite club of Major League Baseball without earning his way there, which is how the players have to do it. "McNamee's leading the team in stretching, and he's Rogers' guy," Cohn said. "And then there's Jeff Mangold, who's another Gold's Gym guy from Jersey who wasn't qualified to have a big league job, I thought. I never understood why major league clubs would not use guys internally. Train them the way you want them to train them, and hire them in that position. I never understood that. None of those guys were ever properly vetted." "I didn't like McNamee. Not that he was a bad guy. I never thought he was properly vetted. Trainers Gene Monahan and Steve Donahue were just like us. They had to go through the minor leagues. They were vetted. They rode the buses. They ate the ketchup sandwiches. They worked their way up to the big leagues. I always thought there is another Gene Monahan in AA or AAA that has three kids and a family and needs a big league job. Why did McNamee get it? He went back and got a quickie degree? The guy was a bullpen catcher in 95 for me. Then all of a sudden he's gone, he comes back, he's doing some sports book. Basically, he's a hustler. And now he's a trainer. I didn't use either one of those guys. I used trainers Gene Monahan or Steve Donahue if I needed something. I never, ever understood that. That was more on principle than anything I saw. And yeah, there were whispers about what was going on, but we really didn't know." What was going on was that the Yankees, like every team in baseball, were increasingly turning to steroids and human growth hormone, and those so inclined now had someone on the payroll and in uniform and on the team plane to provide information and access to those drugs at any time if they so wished. In 2000 and 2001, the Yankees would joke among themselves about guys who worked closely with McNamee, especially the ones who showed obvious strength and body type changes. "He's on Mac's program," was the joke, which often was reduced to the simple shorthand of, "he's on the program." No one knew for certain the details of the program. No one wanted to know the details. These were the days of don't ask, don't tell, don't care. "They were on his program, guys like Roger and Andy and maybe Mike Stanton," Cohn said. "I thought he had some GNC stuff he was putting in shakes, over-the-counter stuff. Maybe creatine or Andro or whatever you can get over the counter. I thought that's what he was doing. I had no idea he had kits of human growth hormone." McNamee intentionally kept a low profile. He rarely spoke or smiled. That was his personality. "If I could go through the day without talking to anybody, it was a good day," McNamee said. Besides, he sensed the friction created by the assumption that he was Roger's guy. "Bernie, Posada, Mariano, Pettit, they all knew me because I was there when they first came up," McNamee said. "But then the pitchers start talking and the players start talking, and it's like a little bitch fest. Oh, go see Mac." Then it was like I was doing my own thing. Go see Mac and the program became understood code for seeking out supplement options, legal or perhaps not. McNamee claims to be personally opposed to illegal performance-enhancing drugs. "I had guys ask me general questions," McNamee said. "I would give the good and the bad, and my recommendation would be not to do it. I can get 200 players now I talked out of doing it, or said no to. but I never said I could get stuff to anybody. I think because of Jason Grimsley, Roger knew that I knew a guy, and because David Justice knew that I knew a guy, and I knew that his stuff was legit, clean and whatever. And that's where the problem started. And I enabled that. And I shouldn't have. McNamee also had a practical reason for not emphasizing steroids. They would devalue his work as a trainer. How could he claim credit for the benefits of a conditioning program, for instance, if a steroid shortcut available to anybody made the biggest difference of all? But by 2000 and 2001, the drug culture in baseball was so firmly established that ballplayers were going to cheat whether McNamee or any other strength coach was on board with it or not. The signs were too obvious. Wells, for instance, would later write in his 2003 book, Perfect I'm Not, Boomer on Beer, Brawls, Backaches, and Baseball, that you could stand anywhere in the clubhouse and be no more than 10 feet away from illegal drugs. Yeah, that's a good guesstimate, McNamee said. Guys were looking in each other's lockers. Guys were searching. That was pretty much it. Some guys were open about it. Some guys weren't. And you wouldn't believe the shit they were taking. I mean, it was like horseshit and crap. Like, they didn't know the toxicity levels. They didn't know orals. They were taking whatever the fuck. They were taking Ritalin, oral steroids. They were taking stuff that was bad for them. And then they're going out all night because they've got amphetamines in them, and they're drinking, and then they're sleeping all day, and then they've got to take amphetamines. It's a vicious cycle. Amphetamines had long been established in baseball to combat the mental and physical grind of the baseball season, but they became a routine part of the game. If you're not cheating, you're not trying, McNamee said. That was the motto. McNamee said players from the Blue Jays and Yankees during his year there would store their amphetamines in their lockers, but disguised in the plastic canisters of over-the-counter supplements. When you see that ripped fuel thing, it was usually full of greenies, McNamee said. He said obtaining amphetamines was easy. Players never even had to leave their own clubhouse. There was a guy in California, a Mexican guy, McNamee said. He'd sit there all day in the clubhouse. Guys would sign bats for him, and he'd give them boxes of greenies. In Anaheim, he'd be sitting there with a satchel full of greenies. There was green and green and light green. That's what they used to make the coffee with. We used to open them up and put them in the coffee in the clubhouse, which I took one time in 1998 and didn't know. I almost had a heart attack. I was out stretching guys. One of the Blue Jays was like, "Did you drink the coffee?" I said, "Yeah. It's right near my locker." He goes, "Never drink the clubhouse coffee. Go to the back." I'm like, "All right. Thanks for telling me." I didn't know one pitcher on Toronto's team that wasn't taking them when he pitched. It's speed. Guys were beaning up to play golf after workouts. The prevalence of amphetamines contributed to the general acceptance of illegal drugs in clubhouses. Steroid use had spread virally around baseball. Seguí, for instance, was traded in the second half of the 1999 season from Seattle to Toronto, where he met McNamee. McNamee went to the Yankees the next year, where he met pitcher Jason Grimsley. McNamee gave Grimsley Seguí's telephone number, knowing both were interested in performance-enhancing drugs. And then one day, during that 2000 season, McNamee was sitting with Grimsley in the Yankees' bullpen during a game, when he happened to mention that he really liked the Lexus RX 300 SUV. "Really?" Grimsley said. "I know a guy who works with Lexus." Grimsley gave McNamee the name and telephone number of his friend. His friend's name was Kirk Radomski. McNamee called him and arranged to meet him at a car detailing shop. "And that's how I met him," McNamee said. Radomski and McNamee became friends and business associates. Much later, after the feds closed in on them, they also became star witnesses in the Mitchell Report. The connection became a convenient one for Grimsley, who was purchasing his drugs from Radomski. Why not, Grimsley figured, have McNamee do his legwork? He asked McNamee to pick up his kits of human growth hormone from Radomski. McNamee obliged, even though he was putting himself into the dangerous area of drug distribution. "He asked me to pick up some stuff for him in Knobloch," McNamee said. That's how that started. That was three times, and I stopped it, because I didn't feel good about it. Members of the 2000 Yankees became good business for Radomski. At some points over the 2000 and 2001 seasons, according to the Mitchell Report, Radomski provided drugs for Grimsley, Knobloch, pitcher Denny Nagel, outfielders Glenn Allen Hill and David Justice, and later for pitcher Mike Stanton. In addition, the 2000 Yankees included three other players who later admitted their drug use, though not necessarily specific to that particular year: Jose Canseco, Jim Leyritz, and Andy Pettit. Most infamously, the 2000 Yankees had a 10th player who would be tied to reports of performance-enhancing drug use: Clemens. According to McNamee, Clemens came to him in the second half of the 2000 season looking for a boost. McNamee turned to his friend Radomski for steroids and human growth hormone. McNamee said he injected Clemens 4 to 6 times with the steroids and 4 to 6 times with the HGH. Clemens, who turned 38 years old in August that season, pitched far better in the second half than he had in the first, lowering his ERA from 4.33 at the All-Star break to 3.15 after it, while improving his record of 6-6 before the break to 7-2 after it. The Yankees finally saw the pitcher they traded for from Toronto. Did the players assume Clemens was on the program? I think the fact that I picked up some stuff for Knobloch and Grimsley, there was an assumption they talked about it too, McNamee said. I would think you would have to assume that Roger was taking something. I never talked about it. And I didn't want steroids and human growth hormone to be the be-all, and that's why Roger was performing well. I made that clear to Andy once I knew he knew. He understood that. I think you would have to be an idiot not to think Roger was taking something. Of course, such thinking did not stop McNamee from writing a guest column in the New York Times later that same year that was titled, "Don't Be So Quick to Prejudice All That Power." In it, McNamee wrote, "The suggestion that steroids are the answer to the increased strength, recovery from injury, and the improved performances of today's players is just wrong." He concluded his opus thusly, "Yes, the players today are stronger, faster, and smarter than their predecessors. But their superiority is not because of steroid use, but because of the advancement in sports-specific science and commitment of the organizations to strength, conditioning, and nutrition. To suggest otherwise is irresponsible and disrespectful." It was, naturally, a complete lie. Baseball had become one fraud piled upon another. "I did lie to the media," McNamee said, "because I got tired of going to clinics and kids asking me about steroids. I went out of my way to say no, never, never, never. I lied. But to me, what was I going to do? Oh yeah, this is the way you should work out, but by the way, my guys take steroids." So I had to answer the question. Me, as a trainer, can't say, "I don't want to talk about it," because that's an admission of guilt. The fact that I enabled it was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. But it was a gray area for me, because the way I got involved with Radomski had nothing to do with steroids. And it's a personality flaw when you look at my job. My job is to protect these guys at all times, before, during, and after. So when these guys are already doing something that's wrong, I tried to help that. Because they're going to do it anyway. Was it wrong for me? I don't know if I would do the same thing again. I should have said no, but I can't. I have an inability to do that. The 2000 Yankees won the American League East Division with 87 victories, stumbling badly to the finish by losing 15 of their final 18 games. They held off Oakland in the division series in 5 games, dispatched Seattle in the American League Championship Series, in which Clemens won Game 4, 5-0, with the most dominating game of his postseason career, a one-hitter in which he struck out 15 batters and threw 138 pitches, and then took out the Mets in 5 games to win the World Championship. Radomski said he provided drugs to at least 2 Mets players on that team, Matt Franco and Todd Pratt. The Yankees were the best team in baseball, and when it came to steroids, they were no different from anybody else. "You had 2 guys from New York doing all the talking in the Mitchell Report," Torrey said. "That's why you have more information on New York players. If people want to devalue the 2000 team, is that how we lost 15 out of 18 down the stretch? We dried ourselves out and then got a heavy dose for the postseason? One thing I've learned is that people are going to feel the way they're going to feel, regardless of what happened. You can talk until you're blue in the face, and there's no answer that's going to satisfy everybody, said one former All-Star and steroid user who competed against those Yankees teams. Everybody around baseball did what they could possibly do. It was the survival of the fittest. Nobody said this has to stop? Who would have? The player said, laughing. It's why the government regulates monopolies. If people could do it, they would fucking do it. Just like cheating on your taxes. If there's a gray area, you're going to find it until the government said it's not a gray area anymore. The player said that everybody in the game just understood that attitude was acceptable. Now, whether it was right or wrong, now you're talking about a moral issue. But there were no rules. You did what you did. It was the Wild, Wild West. Tori came from a generation in which weight training and adding bulk were taboo. Steroids? He knew nothing about them. He never saw them. The players certainly weren't going to tell him what was going on, and he wasn't going to probe without invitation into their private lives. I've always tried to respect guys' privacy, Tori said. I remember in Atlanta in 1982 we were going to the postseason, and rumor had it they were going to check bats to see if any were corked. It was the time when loading bats was one of the things that was starting up. I remember having a meeting and saying, "Guys, I never ask you what you do, but I know we've accomplished something very special here by winning the division, and if they decide they want to check bats, it could nullify everything we've ever done here. So if you're going to do it, you better be careful. And if you weren't, don't even worry about it." That's basically been my attitude, unless I see erratic behavior sometimes. Unless somebody acts funny. I just don't go into people's lockers. Plus, I didn't see anything. I walk all over the clubhouse. I walk in the trainer's room. I walk in the lounge. I walk in the weight room and all that stuff. I never saw it. I never heard players talk about it. Jeter used to kid about it. He'd joke around, "Yeah, watch me on steroids, hit it to the warning track." The thing that comes to mind with steroids is that it can cut your life short. The other thing is I don't think it's fair. The analogy I use is that it's like some guys are using metal bats and some guys are using wood bats. It's not right. It's dangerous. The one thing you have to remember is that baseball is business that has never interfered with putting asses in the seats. You can't tell me that with everything going on, Babe Ruth hits 60 home runs in 1927, Roger Maris hits 61 in 8 more games in 1961, and then in 1998, 2 guys hit more than that, that nobody thinks it's suspicious? In 1998, when one guy hit 66 and one guy hit 70, baseball said it's great. And now baseball is pointing the fingers at everybody? That's the fraud to me. Not all 10 members of the 2000 Yankees in the Mitchell Report were described as using drugs during that particular season, but the cooperation of McNamee and Radomski gave that team a higher profile than others in the report. For instance, outfielder and admitted steroid user Shane Monahan has said steroid and amphetamine use was rampant on the 1998-99 Mariners teams he played on. Monahan also described hangers-on with clubhouse access brokering greenies for memorabilia transactions. 9 players from those Seattle teams, both of which lost more games than they won, have been linked in various reports to performance-enhancing drugs. McNamee said the 2000 Yankees were no different from the 29 other teams when it came to drug use. "I think the talent level was better," McNamee said. "You put ergogenic aids on top of that, you're going to get a better team." McNamee said he told federal agents and Mitchell's investigators that both Toronto general manager Gord Ash and Yankees general manager Brian Cashman did not want to know if players were doping, and that player agents were directly involved in procuring illegal drugs for their clients, but that Mitchell did not include those comments in the report. Gord Ash and Brian Cashman denied McNamee's assertion. "I told the federal agents and George Mitchell's people that the general managers came up to me and said, 'We don't care what they're taking. I just don't want to know about it,' McNamee said. That wasn't in their report. Cashman denied McNamee's allegations, saying, "We thought we had a clean clubhouse. I never had a dialogue with him about what players may or may not be taking. Never, ever once." Ash also denied McNamee's allegation. "I don't recall that," Ash said. McNamee described his relationship with Cashman as a friendly one. Indeed, McNamee said in 2007, 6 years after the Yankees did not retain McNamee as the assistant strength coach, Cashman called him regularly to consult on strength training issues regarding the team. "If he didn't understand what was going on with steroids, then he's a jackass," McNamee said. "But what was he going to do? If he wanted a clean clubhouse, he would have had to have said, 'Hey, we're getting our asses kicked. Everybody take him.' That's the reality. I know what would have happened. You've got to be on a level playing field." McNamee's run with the Yankees ended after the 2001 season. The team chose not to invite him back, principally because of an incident on October 6, 2001, at the team's hotel in St. Petersburg, Florida, while in town there to play the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. Police questioned McNamee in connection with a possible sexual battery incident after he was found in the hotel pool at 4 a.m. with a 40-year-old woman. Both were naked. The woman had ingested GHB, an odorless substance commonly referred to as a date rape drug. McNamee was never charged. Though the Yankees cut ties with McNamee following that season, Clemens and Pettit continued to train with him and would do so for a year. In May of the following year, 2002, Pettit gave McNamee a call. The trainer was on the road with the Yankees and Clemens, this time not as an official member of the team, but only as Clemens' personal trainer with no special access. Pettit was in Tampa, where, on the disabled list after making only 3 starts that season, he was working out at the Yankees' training complex to rehabilitate a strained left elbow. "I need some help, Mac," Pettit said. It wasn't just McNamee's training help that Pettit wanted. It was human growth hormone. "You don't need to do that," McNamee told the pitcher. "Yes, I do," Pettit told him. "I'm going to do it. Are you going to help me or not?" McNamee decided he wasn't about to change Pettit's mind. There was only one thing to do. "I'll help you," McNamee said. "Good," Pettit said. "Can you get it for me?" "Yeah, I can get it," said McNamee. "I don't even know how I got it down there. I didn't travel with it." Pettit would go to the Yankees training complex in the morning for 30 minutes of treatment. McNamee then would train Pettit through conditioning and rehabilitation exercises. They would run through another training session at night. It was hard work, designed to get Pettit back into the rotation as soon as possible, while the Yankees, stuck in second place, tried not to fall too far behind the red-hot Boston Red Sox in the AL East. But the training regimen wasn't enough for Pettit. Twice each day, once in the morning and once at night, McNamee injected Pettit with human growth hormone. Pettit was a church-going, God-fearing Texan, known in the Yankees clubhouse for his integrity and earnestness. If Pettit was going to cheat, who wouldn't? Of course, even Pettit did not consider injections of an illegally obtained performance-enhancing drug as cheating. "I think he rationalized it with the information I supplied and why guys took it," McNamee said. "I think he just really wanted to heal. It wasn't a performance-enhancing issue. As far as I know, he never took steroids. Everybody thought he did because when I started training him, he went from 88, 89 miles per hour to 96. If you have a photo of him taking steroids, I don't know. I don't know what to believe." Torrey never knew about Pettit's HGH use. He learned about it at the same time as the rest of the world, when the Mitchell Report was released in December of 2007. Pettit was in the middle of preparing a statement in which he would admit to using HGH when Torrey called him. "Andy, I'm just calling to see how you're doing," Torrey said. "I'm not calling to ask any questions." "Skip," Pettit said. "I'm just getting ready to make a statement." "I don't want to know your statement," Torrey said. "I just want to see how you're doing." "I'm okay," Pettit said. Torrey noticed that Pettit sounded anxious or jumpy, as he put it. After Pettit released his statement, the pitcher called his former manager back. "I'm sorry," Pettit said. "I apologize to you. especially if I did anything to put you in a tough situation. I don't know how I did this. As religious as I am, I even question how God can help me make those kind of decisions.
Well, Andy, Tori said, we don't always make the right decisions. It's what life is all about. Just knowing you the way I know you, and not a lot of people know you like I do, you were torn because you thought, being on the disabled list, the most important thing was to get yourself back to earning your money and helping the team. You were willing to try something, and then you realized you didn't want to do this anymore. So what did you do? You stopped.
It's what you did.
Is it the right thing? The wrong thing?
It's what you did. You certainly didn't have anything really devious in your mind at the time. You were just trying to get back to earn your money. You weren't trying to get back there to win a game for yourself.
I feel badly about it, Pettit said.
And what about the other donkey? Tori said.
Pettit knew Tori was referring to Clemens.
Roger is Roger, Pettit said. When I talked to him, he was Roger.
Tori immediately understood what Pettit meant about his good friend. That a full-blown steroids scandal wasn't about to change Clemens from being the most cocksure cowboy on the planet. Clemens lived in his own world, surrounded by people who unequivocally verified it for him, and George Mitchell wasn't about to cause him any self-examination or doubt. Tori also understood how Pettit fell victim to the culture of the times.
It's like Bob Gibson said, to win a game you'd take anything, Tori said. We'd all sell our souls. Winning is something that was first and foremost, and that's what we wanted to do. Unfortunately, now what stimulates the need to do this is individual performance and not winning. It used to be all about winning. It was, let's win this game, let's go to the World Series. That was the motivation at the time. Now it's more a case of the motivation being my numbers. But yeah, as a competitor, you'd sell your soul.
Pettit might not consider his HGH use to have been cheating or performance-enhancing. The Red Sox, of course, might view it a little differently. Pettit was off the disabled list and back in the rotation on June 14th. The Yankees trailed Boston by 1.5 games. Pettit made 19 starts thereafter, and was one of the best pitchers in the league at that time, going 12-4 with a 3.29 ERA. With Pettit's help, the Yankees overtook the Red Sox and won the division with 103 victories. The Red Sox won 93 games. They did not qualify for the playoffs.
At about the very same time Pettit, with McNamee's help, was in a hotel suite in Tampa sticking needles loaded with HGH into the folds of the skin in his abdomen, and 4 years after Helling's first of several pleas to the Players Association fell on deaf ears, Ken Caminiti sat across from a writer in a lawn chair in his garage in Houston, surrounded by his show-quality muscle cars, and made an announcement that was a long time coming. The Emperor had no clothes. Baseball, Caminiti said, was rife with steroid users. It was a moment that would change how baseball would be played and administered. It was the beginning of the end of the steroid era, at least its Wild West days, with no laws in place in the game. Not only did Caminiti, a former Most Valuable Player Award winner, then in his first year of retirement, admit to using steroids himself, making him the first among the hundreds and hundreds of players who had used steroids to actually admit it, but he also expressed absolutely no remorse about having done so. Steroids were so prevalent, they had become the default choice if you wanted to make it as a big leaguer. How could you feel guilty about it if about half the players, as Caminiti estimated, were doing the same thing? What he said was not shocking at all. Baseball had given itself over to steroid users for more than a decade, though, as Cohn observed, the rate of those crossing over to the dark side had greatly accelerated over the previous 4 years. By 2001, it had reached its tipping point. Clean players, such as Helling, began to see themselves as the minority, put at a competitive disadvantage by the growing acceptance that steroids simply were, like occasional brushback pitches, now part of the cost of playing baseball. Steroids were no longer part of a rogue element,
They were de rigueur. This important shift among the rank and file of players became clear in the second half of that 2001 season. Perhaps the breaking of the home run record yet again, this time by a garishly pumped-up version of Bonds, who hit 73 at the age of 36, after never having hit more than 49, helped fuel the intramural carping. Several clean players steered conversations toward this growing acceptance of steroids. They were concerned and angry, of course, though the thin blue line mentality among these union brothers and foxhole comrades prevented them from speaking on the record. One of them joked, though with black humor, about the steroid starter kits that made the users so obvious and ubiquitous. In addition to the needles, the steroid user needed acne creams for the pimples that otherwise would fester on his back, and a good razor or wax job to keep the body hairless, the better to show off the new, well-muscled, if bloated, physique. These players became increasingly body image conscious, even if they fairly glistened from the watery, hairless musculature. Some players had slight trouble speaking clearly because the HGH swelled the size of their tongues and jaws. Some players could not push their batting helmet completely down on their heads because their heads had swelled. Of course, steroids hardly were a secret in baseball then. Many media outlets had covered the topic, often with anonymous sources, and the Mitchell Report referenced many of those reports. But the topic never gained much traction, primarily because top Major League Baseball officials, union leaders, and active players typically would not admit the scope of the problem or attach their name to a call for action. By April of 2002, the increasing resentment among some players to steroid use was a sign that perhaps the don't ask, don't tell, don't care culture was about to crack. The worst-kept secret in baseball was the growing use and acceptance of steroids. Caminiti, who was a fierce competitor and bluntly honest character over his 15 seasons with Houston, San Diego, Texas, and Atlanta, was the man who broke the coded silence in the pages of Sports Illustrated. "I've got nothing to hide," he said. Still, there was an obvious sadness about him. His virility was gone. Caminiti moved and spoke slowly. His famously intense eyes had gone cold and dull. He complained several times that his body could no longer produce enough testosterone on its own, having grown dependent on the synthetic forms he injected into his body. "You know what that's like," he said. "You get lethargic. You get depressed. It's terrible." The story was enormous. What Helling had been trying to tell the Players Association for 4 years was now broadcast across every network and media outlet in the country. The secret was out, as much as some still didn't want to acknowledge the obvious truth. They wanted to perpetuate the myth. "Everybody hates a snitch," said Cubs manager Dusty Baker, remaining faithful to the ballplayer's omerta. Said Angels slugger Mo Vaughn, "Let me tell you why Barry Bonds hit 73 homers. Because he's a great hitter. Because the Giants moved out of Candlestick Park into a place where the wind doesn't blow as much." Of course, this was the same Mo Vaughn, who was one of Kirk Radomski's best customers. Mitchell's investigators found that Vaughn, who was referred to Radomski by Glenn Allen Hill, wrote at least 3 checks to Radomski in 2001, totaling $8,600 for kits of human growth hormone. Radomski told Mitchell he personally delivered the drugs to Vaughn. Then there was the post-Caminiti reaction of Jason Giambi of the Yankees. "I know this stuff is newsworthy," Giambi said, "but hopefully people don't buy into it. There's no miracle thing for this game. Either you have talent or you don't. One common thread of all the greats of the game, they've had longevity." Of course, this was the same Jason Giambi, apparently short on requisite talent, who was pumping his body full of steroids and human growth hormone. Try as they might, the baseball players could not wish away the steroid issue. 3 months after Caminiti spoke, the Players Association suddenly dropped its long-standing and fierce opposition to random drug testing and agreed to a new collective bargaining agreement that would require all players in 2003 to submit to anonymous survey testing. Before the union would even agree to do something about the steroid problem in baseball, however, the players bargained for an escape clause. A program just to find out if a problem even existed. Real steroid testing would take place starting in 2004, only if more than 5% of the anonymous 2003 tests came back positive, tests the players knew they would be taking in spring training. The players couldn't even keep from using the drugs long enough to beat the tests they knew were coming. Enough ball players still flunked to trigger the real testing program. "It does surprise me a little bit," said relief pitcher Mike Stanton, then with the Mets after his years with the Yankees. "But the tests don't, like, lie." Stanton was surprised. Of course, this was the same Mike Stanton who, according to the Mitchell report, met Radomski when he was a Yankee in 2001 and received from Radomski 3 kits of human growth hormone in 2003, the same year Stanton expressed surprise at the survey test results. Rick Helling was at least one person who was not surprised at what happened to baseball. Baseball in the steroid era was one lie piled upon another, over and over, starting with the lie that baseball didn't have a steroid problem at the time, continuing with the wanton disregard of federal law that there were no rules against steroids, advancing to the lie that steroids did not help anyone play baseball, moving to the lies that go on even to this day, that no one ever seemed to know anyone who used steroids, or, God forbid, actually used the stuff themselves, and including the lies that pass as the career playing statistics for the hundreds of players who knowingly chose to break the law and the seemingly archaic code of sportsmanship. The steroid era was baseball's Watergate, a colossal breach of trust for which the institution is forever tainted. It floats untethered to the rest of baseball history, like some great piece of space junk, disconnected from the moorings of the game's statistics. Like Watergate, the steroid era eventually and assuredly led to an age of discovery, a sort of archaeology of the times in which some of the ugly truths bobbed to the surface or were unearthed by the brushing away of the lies. Reputations were ruined or damaged. Helling was right. It blew up in the players' faces. 2 giants of the game, however, were hit the hardest of all, paying a steep price because their reputations were so outsized in the first place, and then because their personal trainers were ensnared in the legal unravelings of what had happened. One was Bonds. The other was the cocksure cowboy from Texas, who helped deliver Torrey's Yankees to 2 world championships. 4. The Boss. George Steinbrenner would shovel debris out of 6 inches of gunky green water while dressed in his loafers and slacks if it meant winning a World Series, which is exactly what he was doing in the 8th inning of Game 4 of the 2000 World Series at Shea Stadium. A fire had started, and a